everyone, and welcome back to the Phileas Club. It's been so long. I mean, at least a couple of months. I've missed you, all of you, so much. My name is Patrick Beja, and on this show, what we do is that we get people from different parts of the world and try to get the news from those parts of the world, but also get their views on what's happening in our part of the world. More or less, usually it's been, well, COVID is everywhere, and I'm sure we'll talk about that, but also we'll talk about other things, because other things have been happening, including, for those who don't know, I now have two children, and that is more difficult than having one child. I've been told that would be the case. I was warned, and I can confirm it is indeed more difficult. It's funny because let me introduce the guests first. Let's try and be polite. First of all, ladies first, Hannah is back from Malaysia. How are you doing, Hannah?
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah, here in sunny Kuala Lumpur this afternoon.
And we talk about COVID all the time, and obviously it's a big topic of our conversation, especially for you since you work in the tourism industry. So I guess we're going to have things to discuss there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's not a great industry to be in still.
But we're looking towards the end of the apocalypse, hopefully, and or maybe not. In Malaysia, I'll be interested to know how things are going on that, with vaccination and all of that. Because
sure.
I think there's a mood of like, okay, we have vaccines now in the West. And we're like, yay, we're done. Good. Excellent job, everyone. And it seems like it might not quite be that simple long term. But we'll see. We'll talk about that.
Yes.
Also, Bart is here from the greater British Isles land of affiliated with Britain in some form, but not too much, because if you say that, you might get in trouble from where you're from. How's it going, Bart?
It is going well. And Patrick, Republic of Ireland, how's that? That's a nice, easy one.
Mm. But, I want to get it from the start. That, what's happening in Ireland now is, has a lot to do with what's happening across the border. I was going to say the channel, the sea.
Well, no, it's across the border. That's the problem. Exactly. If there was a sea, we'd have much less trouble.
It would be much easier.
It would.
Yeah. All right. So I'm not sure what to start with. Like, do we start with COVID and get it out of the way? Or do we start with Brexit, fall down consequences, or do we start with, I don't know, what you just woke up, Bart, so maybe we'll go to Hannah first and let you, you didn't just
let
wake
me
up,
catch my...
but you just,
I just said about you, right, because I literally, my morning tasks were make tea, listen to 9 o'clock news to make sure nothing had exploded, talk to Patrick.
Well, all right. So we'll let you go over in your head the fact that nothing exploded, apparently. Well, maybe that's a bit too broad. Not everything exploded.
Explosion is still in progress, I would say.
So the explosion is still happening. And let's talk about what's happening in Malaysia. And if you have a view of, the neighboring region, how are things, Hannah, over there?
But you know what? Like, not great. So,
You had me hope for just a second. You're like, you know what? It's not too bad. And yeah, no, that's not. Yeah, silly me. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think when we spoke last year, mm-hmm. and at that time, like, Southeast Asia was doing pretty well. Our cases were quite under control. It's feeling, a little bit smug almost. Ha ha ha, look at Europe, look at America, look at those hundreds and thousands of cases they've got. And then, of course, we had the end of the year here, and then pretty much across the region in Southeast Asia, no matter what country it was. So some countries like Vietnam had very few cases. Laos, I think up till maybe March had less than 50 cases, like 50 cases in the whole pandemic that has zero deaths, 50 cases. And across the board, the numbers have risen in all of these countries. And it's It's kind of hard to say why. I think some of it is down to variants. Some of it is down to the locals just getting a bit complacent, I think. You know, if you've been in a country for so long with such low kind of incidence of COVID, then you're probably not taking all the social distancing measures and everything else quite so seriously. So then when a case does get in and it starts to be transmitted, then it suddenly becomes a lot more serious than in countries that, you know, were perhaps like maintaining more mask wearing, more social distancing kind of protocols.
That's what I've heard. So, yeah. And what, to be honest, I was following this because, I mean, it got to my attention because it seems Taiwan has been hit as well. And there's a lot of manufacturing of, well, almost all of it, of CPUs and chips over there. And the world is freaking out now because they're like, oh, my God, if that affects chip manufacturing even more than, you know, there's so much issues with orders not being fulfilled. Everyone was freaking out, but and that's the explanation people were giving. But the vaccines have not started at all.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing. So yeah, I think Taiwan is surprisingly, I mean, and I don't follow Taiwan so closely, but yeah, has been surprisingly slow. But in general, Southeast Asia for the vaccination rollout has been super slow. I mean, you have got countries, you know, Indonesia has got almost 200 million people. So they're not countries that can be like very easily rolled out. Indonesia is made up of thousands of islands as well. So logistically, it's pretty tough too. But, you know, if you look across the board,
I guess it's also natural social distancing as well, to an extent. Yeah. But
yeah, in a way. But, you know, like right now, I'll just found some stats that the country that's the most advanced, and you would kind of expect this in Southeast Asia, is Singapore. So Singapore has got to about 34% vaccination, but their population is only about 6 million people, so they've got a pretty easy deal, right? It's just distributing it throughout a city. Whereas you've got countries like Vietnam, and they are at 0.09%, and not even at 0.1% yet of their population. And a lot of this is, I mean, what the governments here at least blame this on is Western nations like Europe, like the US, hoarding all of these vaccines. Yeah, exactly. And kind of over ordering. And then, of course, AstraZeneca, we had that whole Europe not letting them export either. So I think that also contributed to shortages here in Southeast Asia.
I think looking at it from here, I think everyone would admit that that's the case, especially with now the concern that if we don't vaccinate everyone, variants are going to keep happening because mutations keep happening in, you know, places that haven't been where the pandemic hasn't subsided yet. So I think everyone's aware. What I'm trying to say is, we know we're holding it, and yeah, I think it's fair. Yeah, it's fair to say, yeah. It's not like some kind of how do you call it? Like propaganda that those countries are spinning. I think it's a fair thing to say, at least to this point.
Yeah, I think so. So that's why I'm saying, you know, last year we were feeling pretty smug looking at what a mess Europe and the US are. And now it's almost the opposite way around. You know, Southeast Asia is okay. It's still not at crazy COVID levels like Europe. So I think that the highest kind of daily case rate, I think Indonesia had about 13,000 cases a couple of days ago. They're going through a new surge there. But we have a huge shortage of vaccines. And so just rolling it out itself is, you know, you're probably looking at maybe the end of this year for some countries, for some of the poorer countries or the bigger countries, could easily be midway through next year. And now I'm looking at all these pictures of Europeans going on holiday and I don't know, seeing even, you know, watching the Euros. I'm not a big football fan, but my husband's made me watch some of the highlights on YouTube. Seeing like the full stadiums. That's crazy. I think sitting here in Kuala Lumpur, we're going through quite a strict lockdown again. You're seeing some of the countries where they're allowing full stadiums. You're just, oh my goodness, this is a super spreader event. What's going on?
Yeah, it's...
That's what we're thinking too, by the way.
Okay, good.
Well, I mean, is it? No, I think the
That's my reaction. It's like, okay, I think we've gone nuts, but...
So the way we look at it is, for those events, at least, you know, my impression from looking at it from France, is that you need a, like, health pass, meaning it's not necessarily you've been vaccinated, but everyone needs to show that they are, at least they have been tested in the last 24 hours to attend these big events. And in France, I think we're at 50% of the population that has the first dose. And, you know, I don't remember how much has the second dose, but maybe 20, 30, something like that. The US is even more vaccinated. And of course, herd immunity is reached at about 70% of fully vaccinated people. So we're not there yet, but we're making good progress. And I know that the EU has pledged to send millions or dozens of millions of vaccines to countries that need it, because people are aware that you need to vaccinate everyone. But of course, you know, it's not dozens of millions, it's hundreds of millions or billions of vaccines that you need to vaccinate everyone, and everyone needs to be vaccinated. So I think certainly the not quite euphoria, but the feeling of, okay, we're done, especially because the next wave should arrive in the fall. And by then, we're hoping that the most of the population will be vaccinated, with that idea that initially in France, at least, it was like 60% of the population was saying, oh, I'm, you know, reluctant to get vaccinated, which was crazy. And everyone was going, well, not everyone, but people were thinking, oh, my God, we're doomed. And now we're at like 20% of the population only who's saying, I'm not so sure about that vaccine. So, but it has been slowing down the vaccination rates, because there are less people who are willing to go down to the center and get vaccinated. It might also be because of the holidays and everyone's outside and, you know, they don't care. But I'm guessing that mostly throughout Europe, by the end of the year, or, you know, by the fall or the end of the year, we might be close to reaching herd immunity. So I think our attitude here is not as suspicious as it would be for you, Bart. Is that in Ireland, is the situation very different?
I don't know. It just... like, it's more... I get the impression that there's a... just like last summer, things are going well, so there's a rush to just race straight back to normal, get out ahead of the, you know, do more than we probably should, speed up the reopening. And for Ireland, that was catastrophic last year.
What's the vaccination rate in Ireland right now?
We're doing okay. I think we have about 60-ish% with the first dose.
Okay.
But with the Delta variant, that's proving to be quite meaningless. It's the second dose that really matters. And we copied the UK, and we did that long gap between first and second doses of AstraZeneca.
Mm-hmm.
And so now everyone's going, okay, so we did our most vulnerable people first, and we gave them AstraZeneca and told them for a 3-month wait. And now it turns out there's a variant that doesn't care that you have one dose. And so now we're scrambling to shorten the gap for those people. So on the one hand, it is definitely the case that we're very efficiently getting through every vaccine that gets into this country. So there are no large stockpiles. There's no vaccine we're not using. There's nothing going to waste. So I want to be positive about a rollout, because I think that's the way it should be, right? Every bit of supply the government can get, they can get into an arm. Great.
300 new cases per day. Like, that's not a lot. I don't know.
It feels not a lot, Patrick, but we're a small country. So this time last summer, we were at like 10 or 20.
Okay.
So we're still an order of magnitude up from, like, last summer when we reopened initially cautiously. And then in September, we lost a run of ourselves. Last summer, case numbers were in the single digits some of the days.
Yeah, but there's also, I mean, the vaccine, I don't know how dire the Delta variant is, but the vaccination isn't necessarily going to prevent you entirely from getting it, but it also lessens the gravity, you know, the seriousness of the illness if you do contract it. Maybe the Delta variant messes you up.
Okay, so we had a big news story yesterday where it looks like an outdoor gathering was a mass spreading event of Delta.
Right. Oh, I'm sure it's going to spread.
No, but an outdoor gathering.
Okay.
Was a mass spreading event. That is not how things have, like, early COVID outside didn't happen for that virus, right? Mm-hmm. It didn't spread outside. There was very good research out of Ireland that literally had the headline of the journal paper, COVID does not spread outside. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it made news on BBC World News. Like, it was a good scientific finding and it was true. And now we have a documented case of an outside super spreader event.
We'll adapt. It's fine. It's okay. Maybe I'm being a little bit optimistic, but I think you're, obviously, if the Delta variant means that outside is just as dangerous as inside, yeah, we should.
Don't get carried away. It's not just as dangerous.
Right.
But it's not the get out of jail free card we've been treating it as. Yeah. So,
okay.
What has me worried is that we had decided that we're going to have an outdoor summer. That was the government's policy. They literally branded it as an outdoor summer. And then they're saying, and we're going to open indoor dining earlier than planned on the 5th of June. And now the Delta variant is spreading and they're going, no, we're going ahead with indoor dining. And I'm thinking, you're doing that thing where you stick your head in the sand and you doggedly stick to a plan you made when the facts were different. You're doing it again. And the last two times you did that, it exploded in our faces.
Okay. All right. It is difficult to balance how to, it's not just about the economy. It's also people's well-being and mental health. And I think a lot of people are very quick to say, we should not open anything. We should stay indoors forever, and you know, until everyone is vaccinated, and you know what I mean.
Just to be clear, I'm not saying that. Right? Okay. I am absolutely not saying that at all. I am not one of those people. I am saying is that we are doing that thing where the medical advice is telling us how much we should loosen, which is quite a lot, and the government are going further. And every time they have gone further, it has exploded because, strangely enough, the medical experts know what they're talking about.
You know. I'm sure longtime listeners of this show will be surprised at me saying this, but experts are incredibly important, but they also often are very, very focused on their area of expertise and don't take into account the other realities of life. And so I'm not saying...
Okay, so for context, Patrick, in Ireland, we have a large committee with a very diverse area of expertise that's advising the government.
Yeah.
So it's not a silo. It's basically, it's a broad range of experts, including people who are concerned about things like mental health. And also, actually, strangely enough, one of the big feeders into the government's policy and stuff is actually a regular survey of people's attitudes. Which is kind of an interesting input because the government are afraid that if they restrict too much, people will ignore the advice completely.
Yeah.
Well, and it will be as if they had restricted too little.
Yeah.
And so they're actually feeding that into the decision making, which is good.
Okay. Well, I look at the numbers out of Ireland and compared to France, it's like, you're fine.
But don't look at them.
No, I understand. I understand what you mean.
You have to look per capita. You can't just look at them as raw numbers.
Of course. But getting back to Southeast Asia, how do you see the summer going? Like, do you think you're still in the situation that you and we were in last year? And for all of you, it's really like, oh, it's nice that you guys are feeling better, but we're still in poo-poo here. And F all of you, like, does this have this kind of feeling, or?
Malaysia, definitely. I mean, last week, so we, since about January, our cases have been going up. So right now, well, they hit a peak of about 9,000 and something, which is the highest it's ever been. And the government freaked out and implemented a hard lockdown, which is what kind of the people have been calling for the last couple of weeks anyhow.
Looking at the numbers, and starting with the end of April, it's like, phew, it's like Apple stock going up and up and up. And you can see it going down a little bit from 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, and so last Monday, the government, the Prime Minister, released his plan to get everybody out of this mess, because everybody's been calling for this. And basically, according to this kind of phased recovery, so we're in stage one. Stage four, which would only just about then see interstate travel, just interstate, right? Just being able to go to the state next door. That might happen in October or November. So it's pretty bleak, actually, sitting in Malaysia right now, looking at this timeline, and they've set different criteria. So right now we're in this very hard lockdown. Everybody's meant to be working from home, only essential services open. And to get from this stage to stage two, where that might open slightly more, as in maybe a few more offices will be allowed to open, we've got to have our cases down to 4,000. They've got to have been there for at least 7 days. The population has got to reach 10% vaccination fully, and ICU usage has got to be at 75%. And you just look at some of the other, you kind of, even if you just look at the vaccination rate. So right now, Malaysia is less than 5%, right? So the vaccination minister yesterday was saying, oh, maybe we'll reach 10% in mid-July. So we've got another 3 weeks of this really, really hard lockdown. You know, in terms of the economy, it's just tanking, and being in tourism and being told essentially domestic tourism isn't even going to be able to happen until October, perhaps at the earliest. It's just gutting. I mean, domestic tourism here hasn't been open since mid-January properly. So if you are, you know, a local tourism business right now, you've had no income since mid-January, and you might not get any income until October. And there's not really, you know, Europe has been really great at doing all of these furlough schemes and subsidies. Here in Malaysia, there is some subsidy, but it is not to the extent of Europe. You know, it's not to be able to keep these companies going. So all of these companies are folding. You know, hotels are closing down, people are losing their jobs. Yeah, it's a little bit depressing. I mean, you've got other countries like Singapore. At least they're getting through vaccination. I think by August, I think everybody would have had their first dose by then. And so they're kind of making these steps towards opening up. But the whole mood here is just super cautious. Everything is just really, really, really cautious. No one wants to open up their borders. The exception is maybe Thailand. You might have seen the headlines that from the 1st of July, Phuket is opening up to vaccinated travelers without any quarantine. But even just for that, there's a ton of paperwork that travelers have got to get through, or they've
Of
got to stay
course,
on
yeah.
Phuket for 2 weeks before they can go anywhere else. So even that in itself is super restrictive. So the governments are just being very cautious. I mean, and I think they all got spooked by India. You know, India is such a close neighbor for Southeast Asia that when all these cases were skyrocketing, I think just Southeast Asia just looked at that and went, whoa, I don't want us to end up like India. Oh my
Yeah.
God.
And you're not looking
Super
at
cool.
the Chinese or Russian vaccines to because we're not using those. I'm guessing they're, I mean, they have a lot of people to vaccinate as well, but
Yeah, well, that's the other issue, I suppose, with Southeast Asia, is that we are really heavily reliant on, as a region, on the Chinese vaccines as well. So Sinovac, Sinopharm are some of the main vaccines being used here. Sputnik 5, a little bit, the one from Russia, but
Yeah.
mainly it is coming from, I mean, the main ones, okay, AstraZeneca, Pfizer, yes, they're here, but especially the poorer countries, let's say Cambodia or Laos, Indonesia, they're mainly relying on the Chinese vaccine. And so, okay, the travelers in these countries are looking and saying, okay, or let's say I am allowed out to leave and go on holiday. Actually, I can't go visit Europe because they're not recognizing the Chinese vaccines.
All right.
So there's going to be that issue too. I mean, my view is eventually Europe is going to have to accept Chinese vaccines, right? Because there's no way they can just stop Chinese people coming into Europe forever because they make so much money for Europe. They're going to have
I
to
mean, I
recognize
guess
it at some point.
once we have herd immunity, maybe we're like, okay. But yeah, I don't
Yeah,
know. It's
so.
I really feel though that like we're hopefully, let's say, you know, it's so weird because we talk about these things and I'm like, yeah, we should also like get the most vulnerable people vaccinated everywhere and include in poorer countries and. But if you ask me, you know, I'm like, oh, so Patrick, you don't want your vaccine? I'm like, well, you know what? It's tough. And maybe I could go without mine because I'm so isolated that it doesn't, you know, for me specifically, it doesn't matter all that much. But I can understand that people who live in a city are like, you know, I really want to help. But it's weird how I've been reading The Expanse, and this will connect back to it. You know, The Expanse, science fiction novel, really well written, a great TV show adaptation. And there's a character in that called, anyway, it's Amos. And at some point, he's in a situation where there's a catastrophe. And he says, when you're in a bad place, in a bad situation, your tribe gets smaller. And it really feels like this bad situation has made our tribes get back to, you know, this among many other situations, get back to the national level. Like, it's best case, it's regional level at the very least, but maybe national as well. It's like, we'll get our stuff first, and then you can have yours, and it's going to be fine. But, like, you know, like, we'll order a billion vaccines for us first. All right? Cool. Yes. And it's weird because I can't, you know, I don't know how to get out of that aspect of it. If there was some kind of international coordination system that would say, we need to vaccinate the most vulnerable people first everywhere, and then we get the people who travel, and then, you know, it would be great, but I don't know.
Yeah, no, totally. I think even within Southeast Asia, so we have our version of the EU, ASEAN, and that's been pretty much useless. You would think that, I mean, they don't have as much powers and they are not as cohesive as the EU anyway, the way it's governed. But you would think just amongst these countries, right, there's only 10 of them. There's not a lot of countries to coordinate. Even between those, they haven't managed to recognize each other's vaccination certificates or figure out how to, you know, perhaps if they had bunched together at the beginning and said, let's all procure the vaccines together as a block, that could have made a difference. But no, like you say, it's like every country for themselves.
You know, I still really think that, let's say it's going to last for, let's go with the idea that the variants aren't going to mess everything up. It's going to slow things down and it's going to make everything a little bit more difficult. But by the end of 2022, I think, I hope, and I think everyone will be in a safer place. I think for the West, as I was saying before the beginning of this year, by the end, you know, by the summer, we're seeing the impact of vaccination. And by the end of summer, it's going to be, you know, and definitely the end of the year, it's going to be a lot of closer to normal than it has been. But for the rest of the world, give it another year. I still have a positive view of this because this is one of the toughest global catastrophe that we've been faced with ever. And hopefully within 3 years of its beginning, it's going to be handled. So we'll see what happens. But
that'd be about on schedule, right? For if you look at Spanish flu, that was 3 years of trouble.
Sure. But with less, we'll have had bit less, you know, death and stuff. But and well, anyway, all right. COVID is still an ongoing story, we'll talk about it for a long time. The other ongoing story, of course, is is Brexit. Bart, how are things going in Ireland related to? I'll be honest. I don't know, Hannah, if you'll agree. Of course, as people have heard, given your accent, you're from the UK originally.
Yep.
I don't know if you'll agree with me, but I think Brexit has been, this can be understood both ways, but it has been going roughly as well as can be expected, meaning not too bad is what I mean in the UK. I don't know if you would agree with that assessment. Maybe you're looking at it a little bit closer, but looking at it from here, and we've had other issues to worry about, it seems like, yeah, there are issues with selling stuff and buying stuff, but Or do you think it's the disaster anti-Brexit have been calling you?
Yeah, I mean, I am anti-Brexit. So overall, I still think it's an absolute disaster. I mean, It's funny because I have been on the outside, and of course, I haven't been back to the UK since Brexit either. I just think the government got a bit lucky with COVID. It depends how you look at it, but at least they can blame anything from the economy on COVID rather than on Brexit. So in a way, that's given them a little bit more leeway. But yeah, it's just from a distance, it's just a confusing mess still, I think.
Okay. All right. From a little bit of a closer distance, Bart, how does it look? What could you say about the UK? But more importantly, you know, just in 10 seconds, and then more importantly, it seems to be having an impact on Ireland.
Well, so the 10-second version is ticking time bomb. That is because Brexit hasn't happened yet. I know that sounds astonishing.
Wait, what?
To say. I know. Bear with me. I will explain. So finally, after the transition period in January, in theory, we were all done, right? But there was another transition period where Northern Ireland had some grace to implement its requirements under the Northern Ireland Protocol.
Yeah.
And the British government have now twice unilaterally extended that grace period. And the EU are getting more than a little bit impatient with the UK signing up to a deal and then wiping their bottoms on it.
What?
Imagine Boris Johnson not following through on his commitments.
Just to make sure I understand, the UK government, which had an agreement with the EU to deal with that situation within a year, they're like, oh, we'll do it. Like, we have an extra 3 months or 6 months or whatever it is.
Okay, so the within a year bit was ended in January, right? So that was when everything was supposed to come into force. But the actual physical checking, there was a 3 month period where people were, you know, they were supposed to do the paperwork, but there weren't going to be any physical checks. And, you know, we're just sort of give it a chance to bed in. We don't want to cause all the shop shelves to be empty. We'll give it 3 months. It'll, you know, give us some time to get settled in. And as those at the end of March approached, the British government just unilaterally extended it. And then they did it again. And Brussels
were
like,
Brexit is making everything difficult, or?
Well, that is, there is certainly that, because shock and or horror, you know, when you don't have a trade treaty, it's more difficult to trade. Who would have known? But the real issue is yet again Northern Ireland, right? It comes down to the fact that we have a land border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, and Northern Ireland is now not in the EU, and Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, is now in the EU. In order for this island to remain at peace, it is vital that border remain open. If that border closes again, it will be back to the 80s and the 90s. It will be back to what was euphemistically called the Troubles. We're already seeing a disturbing amount of paramilitary organizations raising their heads again. And it's all being triggered by Brexit, frankly. So in order for that to flow, the only way to square that circle was to have checks between the UK mainland and Northern Ireland. So that Northern Ireland is in effectively a common trade area with the EU, but the rest of the United Kingdom isn't. So that means there is now an internal border within the United Kingdom, purely from a customs point of view, right? So people are not affected by it because Ireland and the UK have a free travel area. But things, so stuff has a border now in the Irish Sea. And that is an anathema to the unionist community. The concept that they are separated from the UK in any notional way, be it through paperwork for customs or anything else, they are now different to the rest of the United Kingdom, and that is intolerable to them. Mm. And so the implementation of those checks that have been negotiated with the EU, because the EU needs to protect a single trade area, the fact that they're not implementing the very, 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 very difficult, right, backstops, everything we've talked about on this show over all of these years has all revolved around what to do about trade with Northern Ireland. They finally had a deal, and now the UK are not living up to their half of the deal. So the EU are going to lose patience.
Meaning, just to be clear, meaning they're not checking things that come in through Northern Ireland into the UK. Is that how they're not living up to their end of the deal?
The other way around. So things coming into Northern Ireland from the UK are supposed to be checked as they arrive. So the port in Belfast, etc. And that's okay. not happening.
Oh, so that's what the EU is concerned about. Not things that get into the UK, but things that get out of the UK is what the concern
Well, it's things from the UK into the north of Ireland, because the north of Ireland is in a common trade area with the EU. So anything coming into Northern Ireland is coming into the EU, into the common market, because from there it can go anywhere else in Europe.
Yes, absolutely. And the UK is not doing it, even though they said they would.
Correct. That is the fundamental issue here. And then to mix everything up and to make it all that bit more of a mess, you have the fact that Northern Ireland is itself a bit of a difficult place to govern, to put it very mildly.
I can sense the restraint you're putting into this phrasing.
I mean, so we have the Good Friday Agreement brought peace to Northern Ireland, and the big thing that brought was the end of that bloody border, which was at the root of so much trouble, and it brought a process whereby you have guaranteed coalition government, which must include both communities. Mm-hmm. So the government in Northern Ireland must include unionists and Republicans. It cannot be single side government again, because that is what caused the terrorism, et cetera, to happen, where the plurality of the country was unionist. They had all government power and they used it to oppress the Republican minority. And so to avoid that happening, the negotiated settlement that brought an end to the IRA's campaign was a very unique form of government, where you democratically elect members of an assembly. And then from that assembly, you build a government in what is arguably a not democratic process, because the biggest party gets to nominate a deputy first minister. And then the other side get to nominate the matching half of that post. And effectively, the prime minister, what they call the first minister, is two human beings occupying one post. And That's if weird. Either resigns, both have resigned. Okay. And they must be from the two halves of the community. Right. It's a complicated process. So because of the fact that the government were going to implement the checks they had legally signed up to implement, effectively, the largest unionist party exploded. Not sure what we want to put it. That party tore itself in half, because you have diehard idealists who don't really care about things like financial realities or what's in the best interest in terms of the North moving forward. They have this notion of there is a border, there must be a border, we are against this. It's emotion, right? It's not logic, it's not reason, it's just diehard, brain-off emotion. And then you have the practical half of the party who are like, no, we actually need to live here in Northern Ireland. We need a functioning economy. We need to make compromises so that this place doesn't explode in a giant big mess.
Yeah, to be 100% clear, I mean, it goes back to the talking monkey issue that we were talking about, you know, for many episodes of our Brexit saga. The half that is idealistic is essentially wants something that is impossible given the terms of the deal that the UK has struck with the EU, correct?
And just given the reality, it does. I mean, the deal they have is the only deal possible when you account for reality. Mm. And once you account
for reality is so annoying. Like, it's so cumbersome.
It really is. It gets in the way, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So the Unionist Party basically fired their leader, which then triggered their leader to resign as deputy first minister, which then triggered the other half of the deputy first minister to be considered to have resigned as well, which then triggered a 7-day period where they had to nominate a new first minister. So the unionists managed to elect themselves a new leader in an extremely, extremely close election, like stupendously close. It was very fractious. You had people walking out of the meeting. It was not a good way to pick a new leader. So poor Edwin Poots got handed the impossible task. He reminds me an awful lot of Theresa May, basically handed a completely poisoned chalice. Dear Theresa, fix this impossible problem. Dear Edwin, fix this impossible problem. So rather than collapsing the Northern Ireland government, he nominated a first minister. The Republicans nominated the second half of that post. And then his party had a motion of no confidence in him for agreeing to have a government in Northern Ireland without the EU agreeing to scrap the Northern Ireland Protocol.
What?
Yep, that's basically it. You didn't manage to get the EU and the British government and the Irish government to scrap everything and just give us what we want. Therefore, you're fired. And so the guy who very narrowly lost just got elected last night. And I say elected, he was the only candidate. So he basically got to have his turn. But he doesn't have any easier time of it than Edwin Poots did. He doesn't have any easier time of it than what it's just.
Okay.
So it looks like there. Okay. So Geoffrey Donaldson has said he is not going to nominate a first minister. So that means the 7-day clock is ticking until the Northern Irish government explodes. Basically, then it's rule from Westminster again, and in theory, run an election.
Okay. So it seems like the interesting thing is that you can look at it and say, okay, this is just Ireland and Northern Ireland. And the problem is, if this doesn't get settled, it affects obviously the UK and the UK-EU deal. And so the entirety of that situation, which has been poisoning the entire region for, what is it, 3 years now? 4 years?
Or you could say since the 70s when the trouble started. I mean,
sure. There was a period of calm until Brexit. But so how do you see things going?
No, you're right. You're right. Sorry, Patrick. You're dead right. After many, many years of very, very difficult negotiation, we had arrived to a place of relative stability, and then Brexit came and upset the apple cart.
Yeah. So
the other thing that's important here is actually an even bigger picture. Because the US have a long history of being on the Republic of Ireland side of things. And the US have made it very clear that they do not want to do a trade deal with a country that doesn't honor its trade deals. So as far as the US is concerned, not actually doing what you promised is a problem when it comes to negotiating a trade deal, because we expect you to do what you promise, and you've just proven you won't.
So the US is not discussing a trade deal with the UK?
They are saying that the trade deal with the UK is contingent on fixing the Northern Ireland problem.
Right. I guess I understand what you just said, Hannah, a little bit better. COVID is kind of convenient in this situation. It's like, what you gonna do? It's tough. We have problems to deal with. It's, you know, it's rare that I don't see a path forward out of a situation. Sometimes you have a path forward that is unlikely, that people are unwilling to take, that is, you know, these kinds of things. Here, we're still back to the talking monkey. Like, people say, I promise you I will give you a talking monkey, and then good luck finding an actual talking monkey. And we're still getting back to that. I mean, the solution that was agreed upon with the EU would work if Northern Ireland would accept it, but they don't, right? That's the key.
I mean, okay, so what should be happening now in a reasonable world is that there are some practical friction points, very practical, mundane things. And the negotiations should really be all about how do we make the protocol actually work, right? So we're experimenting, we're trying, there's a friction point here, this process could be streamlined, okay, let's streamline this process. But instead, we're talking about unionists telling Irish ministers they're not welcome in Northern Ireland with the very obvious hint of we'll blow up or shoot you. There is, last weekend.
This isn't something you're saying for effect. It's actually what is being implied.
Yes, the council, believe it or not, they call it the Unionist Council, but it's actually the leaders of all of the Unionist terrorist organizations got together and released a joint statement to the press saying that Irish ministers are no longer welcome in Northern Ireland. So when a bunch of terrorist organizations tell you you're not welcome, it's not just a vague threat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I'm asking you to be clearer on this, because maybe even some people listening to this don't remember it and think, terrorism is just, Middle Eastern brown men yelling stuff in Arabic. Terrorism is obviously not just that. Terrorism has long history everywhere. And there was a lot of terrorism in Ireland until, I guess, when is the Good Friday? The
90s would be the Good Friday Agreement, yeah.
Like, it was people blowing people up and actually killing people, so...
Every morning, Patrick, you would turn on the news and the question would not be who was killed last night in Northern Ireland, but how many and how bad.
Yeah.
Every day's news started that way. And yeah. there's a smoke screen been thrown up here as well, which I know people in Ireland are listening, but Bart, you haven't mentioned the Irish Language Act, because officially the whole unionist explosion and refusing to nominate a minister, not over Brexit, but officially it's over the fact that there was a promise made many times now as part of many agreements that there will be a law in Northern Ireland establishing support for the Irish language. In fact, they've negotiated to the point where it would be all minority languages, so it would include Scots Gaelic as well, which is a unionist, it's a language in the unionist community. And the unionist party that has exploded has actually twice promised to do it. And the official trigger for firing their 21-day-long appointed leader was that the Irish government and the British government came to an agreement that if the Northern Irish government failed to implement what has already been promised twice, that Westminster would do it for them. And therefore, the Republicans were prepared to go back into government, because even if the unionists continued to not deliver on the promise they twice negotiated, Boris would legislate for it in London. And that was a bridge too far, because not only were the unionists, the extremists in the Unionist Party, not prepared to do what they had already agreed to twice, they didn't want Boris to do it either.
All right. You know, I was in a good mood
I'm sorry.
This morning.
Maybe you should have done COVID last to cheer us all up.
There's a thought, yeah.
Okay, I'll talk about France very quickly, and then we'll bring this to a close. There was an election, departmental election, which is one level of governance. We have like three or four in France, and no one cares about it, and no one went to vote. For context, usually in France, for the big elections, the presidential elections, we have like 80% participation rate. For that one, it was like 35, between 35 and 40. But it's like, I couldn't even tell you what the department level of administration does. Like, maybe I could, but it would be guessing. Like, it's a very minor election. But still, 35% is small. It's in the context of the summer and everyone being, sick of COVID and going out. And we just have lowered the restrictions, et cetera, et cetera. But still, so everyone is freaking out. But the interesting thing out of those elections is that the big winner is the Republican Party, which is actually called Republican now, the Republicans here in France, or over there in France. I haven't been there in like a year and a half. And the big loser was the far right party. So the Republican Party is the right wing party, the conservatives, who have been going more to the right in the past 5 to 10 years. But they're still, the acceptable company party. And the far right party, the Rassemblement National, Marine Le Pen, I'm sure many people have heard about her, was the big loser, which is a little bit puzzling, because in the recent months, we've had a lot of polls that were asking the question for the next presidential election, which is next year, if it comes down to far right versus the center right party, which is currently in power, like it was for the previous election, how would you vote? And the result was very, very close, like even closer than it was last election. And it was very, very close. So a lot of people were saying, oh, my God. The far right party is gaining in power, and they're gonna be a major force for the next election, in the next year, until the election of 2022. And this election seemed to indicate that it wouldn't be the case. And in a twist of, I don't know, irony, the leader of the far right party, which has always benefited from low participation in elections has been saying, because, you know, of course, their base is very energized and goes out to vote, where maybe the bases of the more traditional parties are less energized and don't vote as well. But so for this election, she was saying, oh my God, participation is at an all-time low. Go out and vote, people, please. And it was like, what is
this? That's very backwards.
Yeah, it's very surprising. Again, I think a lot of people are making a lot of, getting a lot of conclusions out of this election, which I feel is not representative for a number of reasons, but it's still, I'm sure it also can't be discounted. So that's an interesting, you know, thing that happened in France. We'll see what happens for the next election next year. But yeah, so that was what was happening in France. In Finland, nothing much. Vaccination is going smoothly. It's really funny because, well, it's not funny at all, actually, but I'm sure you've noticed that Russia is sinking deeper and deeper into totalitarianism. You know, there are more and more laws and moves and decisions being made by Vladimir Putin and the government that make it, you know, a few years ago, it wasn't the case, but now it definitely is. And Finland, as you all know, if you listen to this show on a regular basis, is, of course, has a very long border with Russia and has always been very, very keenly aware of the threat that Russia is for Finland. There's been wars and invasions, and it's like, this is something you have to take seriously. And so a couple of years ago, the government started negotiating the purchase of fighter jets. And it's now coming to a final decision. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I hope I'm getting this number right, but Finland, which is a country of 5 million people, is ordering something like 60 fighter jets. I think the number is right. Even if it was 20, it would be ridiculous, but I think it's 60. And no one is like discussing it, meaning no one is saying we shouldn't do it. They are lowering it. We still have a tremendous healthcare system and, you know, social safety nets, but all of this is being a little bit defunded to fund the purchase of fighter jets. And no, when I say no one, I mean no party, including the, you know, very nationalistic and maybe even that you could think are Russian-friendly parties, no one is saying anything about it. It's like, yep, yeah, we need those. Let's, like, we have a very, we, Finland has a very friendly relationship with Russia, but it's like the epitome of talk softly, but carry a big stick. It's like, it's more than talk softly. It's, we're friends. No problem. Like, we'll talk, we'll trade. Well, it's great. Everything is fine. But also I have 60 fighting, you know, fighter jets in the backyard. So, like, the policy is, if something happens, we have to make it so, like, Finland can't win, but they have to make it so onerous for the, you know, not the Red Army, but the remains of the Red Army or the Russian Army to enter Finland that they will think twice. And that's enough. And that's the policy. And so 60 fighter jets, it's insane. I think it's 60. I hope I'm not mistaken. But yeah. That's what's happening.
I presume Finland are in NATO.
Finland is not in NATO, and that's a huge. We're in the EU, of course, and that is the first thing that Finland did when Russia collapsed. They're like, all right, cool. Now we'll be in the EU, and before that, you know, the Russian bear shakes off their you know, their drunken party time, will be in the EU. That will, and it's a big topic of discussion because there are a lot of people who are saying we should get in NATO and be protected, like be safe. And a lot of people who are, I think, more realistic are like, you do not want to put NATO on the border of Russia. This is like a provocation. It will force Russia to do something. Like, this is insane. You shouldn't do it. the status quo
now
is
not
much
the
better.
Time, I guess, would be the argument. You know, I when mean, relations were good, might have been the time you could get away with it.
Not even, no. Like, that would not... Russia relations are great. It's just that Russia is Russia. It's like, it's our zone of influence. And if you put NATO in, like... It's like, I don't know, it's like Cuba, you know, 2 meters away from the U.S. That's not conducive to... when you're in the cold, the middle of the Cold War, that's not conducive to healthy relationships. You just irritate people. And we know how Russia is with the influence of the EU. And like already the EU can be considered kind of iffy. But
now has its own army, right? So doesn't that mean that if Russia were to invade, the EU would be sucked into a common defense policy?
Absolutely.
And so many EU members are NATO members.
Why do we need to add NATO onto this? Right?
Well, I'm already sort of thinking, protected. Wouldn't NATO just come in by default?
Yeah, kind of, yes. But so you don't need to have Finland be like, you don't need the provocation. You don't need the added insult and injury, right? It's pointless. It's useless. And we need, and it's not like Finland can afford to not have a strong army anyway. So. There's really no reason to be in NATO except to appease some of the people who think it would be like safer. It really wouldn't. I don't think it would be. Anyway,
as long as you're in the EU, I don't see it making a difference. But
I agree. Wait, I agree.
I'm not your opinion.
I don't think it would. I don't think it would. Yeah. Well, so what's the conclusion of this episode? Everything's great. Everything's fine. Things will be fine.
For context, Patrick, if Northern Ireland hadn't blown up and if there wasn't a pandemic, the biggest story in Ireland would have been that our entire healthcare system was taken down by a cyber attack. And weeks later, we're still at 75% of our servers back only. So, yay.
You know what? Next time, I'll invite people who have good news. That's what I'm going to do.
I look forward to listening to that show. Actually, it'd be great if I was on it, but...
All right. Well, thank you very much, both of you, for being on. Before we leave, of course, I'll ask both of you to let us know where we can follow you on the internet. Hannah, still on Twitter?
Not really. Find me on LinkedIn, Hannah F. Pearson, or you can check out my podcast, The Southeast Asia Travel Show. We're on all of the major platforms, so you can search it there and find us there.
Southeast Asia Travel Show. I wonder what you're discussing these days.
Yeah, right? No idea.
Bart, where can we find you on the internet?
Since no one can spell my name, the easiest thing to do is to go to bartb.ie, where you'll find links to stuff like my Twitter and my podcast, Let's Talk Apple, Let's Photography, and the work I do with Alison Sheridan on her podcast, the Nocilla Cast, and our special series we're doing called Programming by Stealth.
Wonderful. Programming by Stealth. That sounds interesting.
Well, Alison threatened for years that when she retired, she would let me teach her to program. And she did. Oh. And I took her up on it. I said, right, you said I could teach you to program. I'm going to teach you to program. And so we snuck up on it by starting with HTML, which isn't really programming.
Oh, that might get you in trouble with some people saying this. But
I will defend that one vigorously.
I kind of agree. It's like, how's it called?
Markup language.
Markup.
That's
language.
The ML.
It's markup.
Right? Yeah, HTML. Markup language.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks to both of you. For me, it's NotPatrick on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. I'm also NotPatrick.com. You'll find links to everything I do, including the French language shows Le Rendez-vous Tech and Le Rendez-vous Jeu, where I talk about tech and gaming every week. And if you enjoy this show, you can support it at patreon.com/thefeedisclub. Very much appreciate all the people who already do. Thank you for your patience with my absence. Having children is not easy, but we will hopefully be back on a semi-regular schedule going forward. That's the hope, at least. The summer vacations are coming up next month, so we'll see what happens there. But after that, absolutely, we'll be back. So thank you very much. Thanks for your support to all the Patreon supporters, and we'll talk to you very soon. Bye.